pleasure to be here this morning, and the approach I'm going to take is to talk about a particular problem that I've been working on over the years as an example of the role of neural modeling in understanding both behavioral and ultimately physiological data, and then suggest the importance of the role of very simple models, neural models, the continuing importance of that. In terms of background for the field, though, let me say, I have a master's degree in philosophy of mind and the history and philosophy of science, and a PhD in theoretical physics. I have never had a course on either vision or psychology or neurobiology in my life. That background, however, enabled me to switch fields as a postdoc and get involved in a lifetime of work in both experimental, including brain imaging, and computational neuroscience. So there's a wide range of backgrounds that can feed into this field. The one thing that you do need is some quantitative competence and background. Okay, I'm going to argue that the key role of neural network models can be understood as follows. And I think this agrees with what probably everyone today is going to say one way or another. First of all, if you look at the sources of data, there's neurophysiology, where even with electrode arrays, you record from maybe 100 neurons at a time at the moment. And at the other end, there's, in my field at least, visual psychophysics. You get a behavioral response, namely some measure of what a person actually sees, person or animal actually sees. And what you really want to do is be able to link those somehow. And I would argue that neural models form the bridge, and really the only bridge we have at the moment, between the neurobiological responses of a few neurons compared to what are really involved and the behavior of the organism. Furthermore, neural models that successfully do that inevitably, because they're essentially always nonlinear, make further predictions that can be tested either physiologically or with brain imaging or psychophysically or in several different ways. So they lead to at least new potential insights, which may or may not force you to change the model. But nevertheless, I see this as the key role of essentially all neural modeling in the field. Okay, now to show you the phenomenon, if you haven't seen it, if you have a pair of the glasses that I handed out, if you put them on, you will see this alternate between horizontal and vertical bars. Does everyone see that? Yeah? Doesn't make any difference. Unless, if you have one very strong eye and one very weak eye, you may not see this. But the point is that there is no alternation going on in the stimulus. The alternation that's being generated is being generated in your brain. So people see that? Yes? Yes? No? Well, I assume people see it. I can see it. Therefore, everyone sees it. What's going on and what we want to understand is that we evolved with forward-looking eyes, mainly because we're very effective predators, and that gives us depth perception under normal circumstances, meaning that the brain can put together two slightly different views of the world to extract the third dimension. This is an anomaly in the sense that presenting vertical lines to one eye and horizontal lines to the other cannot happen in any real world before the advent of mirrors, really. And mirrors have not been an important aspect of our evolutionary past. So this is a default of circuits in the brain designed to do other things. It's literally a kind of switch, and as I'll show you a little later, there is evidence for hysteresis in this switch. Okay, I'm going to concentrate on what we can learn from the simplest possible models as applied to this particular phenomenon. The simplest network that you can use to understand and make predictions of or explain this phenomenon involves in primary visual cortex neurons that are optimally triggered by, let's say, vertical gratings and are monocular, getting input from only one eye. Other neurons that are optimally sensitive to, in this case, horizontal gratings. And we know that such neurons exist from the work of Hubel and Diesel, for which they got the Nobel Prize. And then feedback competition between the two. So these are supposed to be inhibitory neurons, these vertical left eye neurons inhibiting the horizontal right eye, and vice versa. This is the simplest possible network. I'll generalize it to include space when I talk about traveling waves in a few moments, and so forth. The other key is that you can show mathematically that a network like this, if there is strong inhibition and neurons have thresholds, will not alternate unless the excitatory neurons self-adapt in some way. And we know that essentially all excitatory neurons that have ever been looked at, in mammalian brains at least, have usually calcium-mediated potassium currents or sodium-mediated potassium currents that slowly hyperpolarize a firing neuron, so it fires at a weaker and weaker rate. And I'll show you some data on that in a moment. Okay, these are, in fact, those data. The circles here are actual data from a human cortical nerve cell. There have been studies of human cortical cells in tissue removed during operations for grand mal epilepsy, and with the permission of the person whose brain it is, this tissue can then be taken to the lab, and some of the surrounding presumptively healthy tissue can be studied, and people have made recordings, a number of labs, including Avoli's lab at McGill, of responses of human cortical nerve cells to stimulation. This shows that when you first turn on a current, this is a current injected into the neuron, you get, and this is obviously a function of that, the spike rate starts out quite high, but if you wait for a second or two, the spike rate drops by roughly a factor of 3 everywhere. This is the evidence for that adaptation that I was mentioning is present in all cortical neurons. So what's the simplest way we can model this? Well, simply with a threshold nonlinearity. So the first thing we're going to do is ignore the obvious evidence for some saturation at higher current strengths, I'll come back to that, and simply take a model neuron that doesn't fire until it reaches some threshold of stimulation and then just has a linearly increasing firing rate above threshold. And then, of course, it's going to adapt due to slower processes so that the firing rate drops, still linear, but now with a different slope after a second or two. You can encompass all of that in a very simple model. This looks linear except for this little plus sign here, which means that this bracket, which has the input, this would be an excitatory left eye neuron, it gets an external input, let's say from the presence of a vertical grating in the stimulus. It is inhibited ultimately by the excitatory response of the right eye neuron. And it has this slow adapting current, which this is a feedback loop, a negative feedback loop onto itself with a much slower or larger time constant. So the two key parameters here are just the strength of inhibition and the strength of self-adaptation. I'm just trying to illustrate how a very, very simple model can actually account for a lot of data. So A is the inhibition strength, G is a measure of the gain of a hyperpolarizing current, and interestingly, these currents are under control of modulatory neurochemicals, histamine, dopamine, serotonin, so that, in fact, there's even some evidence that states of meditation can alter the rate of this phenomenon, and that would presumably be through altering the strength of this parameter. And finally, as I mentioned, this has to be a much slower process. The other two equations are just for the other eye, so it's symmetric in that way. You can easily derive the requirements for this network to undergo a limit cycle oscillation, or if you prefer, you can call it a relaxation oscillation. First of all, the inhibition has to be strong enough so that equal response from the left and right excitatory neurons is unstable. So the system cannot rest in that state. And with the equations I showed you, you can derive exactly that that's the requirement. And secondly, the self-adaptation has to be strong enough to ultimately have a neuron that's firing drop its firing rate sufficiently so that the other neuron can rebound after it's recovered from its own adaptation. And you can derive an expression for that relating the self-adaptation to the strength of inhibition. If you do that and simulate a network like this, you get this very nice sort of alternation with times on and off that are very similar to what a human experiences if you get them in the lab looking at this phenomenon and pressing left and right buttons to indicate which pattern they're seeing. It's also been done with monkeys. Monkeys perceive this, and people have recorded from cells in their primary visual cortex while they're pushing left and right buttons, telling the experimenter whether they're seeing vertical or horizontal gratings. I should mention, since Andre brought this up, to explain the data more in more detail, you need to incorporate noise because it is not a perfect oscillation. It is an alternation that generates roughly an approximate gamma function distribution of durations of on and off and so forth. But that's easy to do, and I think most of the insights come from the deterministic aspects. Yes. Yes. Why is the period different? Because in this case, I arranged for the stimulus strengths to be slightly different. And in fact, there's a whole literature on that. This model accurately accounts for it. It's called Lebelt's second law, and I left it out because there's not enough time to talk about everything. Well, this would be if you take horizontal and vertical gratings, but make this very high contrast and this not so high contrast. Experimentally, you'll see this, on average, much longer than this. And we can go over that, if you like, in the breakout sessions. I do have slides on it that I'm just skipping here. Okay, one of the other things of using very, very simple equations, and I'm not, by the way, suggesting that this is the only way to do neural modeling. I'm suggesting that it's one way that still provides insights despite the level of simplicity. If you simply make an approximate assumption that the neurons fully self-adapt during the dominance, you can then generate an equation for the duration of either the left or the right eye dominance intervals in this oscillator. And this is accurate it's about 97 or 8% accurate upon comparison with simulations. For the other eye, for T sub R, you just switch this ratio, and that allows you to predict correctly if you don't have the same strength in both eyes, as was just asked, which eye will have a longer duration and by how much. So being able to derive something like this is a result or a consequence of just having very simple nonlinearity, very simple equations. From that, you can obviously take that equation and just plot for all of the different parameters the predicted dominance duration in seconds as you vary any one parameter at a time. There are a couple of things that are fairly obvious. As you increase the strength of inhibition, the oscillation gets slower till eventually you get a bifurcation to a winner-take-all regime where the inhibition is so weak, is so strong that whichever neuron switches on first, it never adapts sufficiently to ever turn back off. Similarly, this I hadn't described, but this is a recurrent excitation parameter. And again, if recurrent excitation gets too strong, you switch to a winner-take-all network, which functions roughly like a short-term memory in that case. And then there's another one here that relates to, I think, something that Andre also mentioned, perhaps. This is the slope of that linear function. And it turns out that the as the slope gets steeper, the oscillation gets slower. And that gave us some insight into a phenomenon, namely that if you change the contrast in both eyes together, if you make it weaker, smaller contrast, the oscillation gets slower. So looking at this backwards, basically, if you start out with a steep slope, you'll have a fairly fast oscillation. If you had a compressive nonlinearity, which I pointed out to you earlier, we in fact do in the responses, and you push the system up the response curve, the oscillation ought to get faster. That's actually called Lavelt's fourth law, after Lavelt, who did some of the really major work on the phenomenon of binocular rivalry in the Netherlands in the mid-60s, although rivalry was discovered in, first mention of it is 1495, I believe. So here's the notion. Dominance duration shorten as contrast increases. That's an experimental fact. If you have the gratings in the two eyes and you make them lower and lower and lower contrast, or turn it the other way around, if you increase the contrast, the oscillation gets faster, the dominance durations shorten. With the compressive nonlinearity, which I've illustrated schematically here, starting linearly and then starting to saturate. Yeah?
Just out of curiosity, with the first slide you showed with the 3D glasses, what was the dominance duration for that contrast level?
Well, it's difficult to know what the contrast level is in this room because there's a lot of ambient light. I would guess that it's all alternating about the dominance durations are maybe a second and a half, somewhere in that ballpark. But it is variable individual to individual, and reliably so. So, for example, if I brought you into the lab and measured it today and then brought you in 3 months from now, there'd be a high correlation relative to the population as a whole between the two rates. It is variable. That's probably due to brainstem modulation by these other neurochemicals. And so forth. So this is just showing that if you now incorporate a compressive nonlinearity into our response function, you indeed can predict that as you increase stimulus contrast, the dominance durations will get shorter, which means the oscillation is speeding up. So the intuition from the approximate derivation turns out to be correct. And just coming back to our original slide, this is the fit now of the compressive nonlinearity. So we're going away now from the just threshold and linear to threshold and linear with a compressive nonlinearity. It fits the data much better, and it explains other aspects of the phenomenon at hand. You get the same thing down here, I just haven't shown it. Okay. Let's move on then briefly to wave propagation. And here, what I want you to do, using the glasses, of course, is fixate the middle of this and pay attention to what's going on out here, but don't look out there. What you should see is that when there are transitions from one pattern to another, the transitions tend to spread around in a wave-like fashion. Do you see that? Here's another example with just a different pair of patterns, only now one of them is concentric and the other is at approximately a 45 degree spiral pitch. We actually got this idea, our goal was to measure the speed of propagation of these waves and see if we could relate it to cortical mapping and so forth. And we actually got the idea of using an annulus like this, sort of like a one-dimensional racetrack conceptually, from Leon Glass at McGill. Actually, Leon and I were graduate students together at the University of Chicago quite a few years ago, and postdoctoral fellows together there. So we've known each other for certainly our professional careers. But he did this sort of thing with cardiac cells from chick embryos plated into an annulus to measure the speed of propagation of calcium waves. And so it's an interesting example of a cross-fertilization between fields. Well, why not use it in vision? And so we triggered these waves at particular locations. And the results, I won't go into detail about how we measured the speed, but this is distance traveled around the annulus, and this is the amount of time it took. And you can see it's almost a perfect linear function, which means a constant speed. Two different subjects. We actually have about six subjects. They all show the same sort of pattern. The first case was where the pattern was propagating at right angles to the bars of the stimulus. And what you can see is that if you have the waves propagating along the concentric pattern, which is the second instance I showed you, the speed roughly doubles. The propagation gets faster. By the way, these results, which we predicted actually the speed in terms of centimeters per second in primary visual cortex, have subsequently been corroborated by an fMRI study where they actually generated these waves in the same way and showed that they do indeed propagate across primary visual cortex at just about exactly the speed we inferred from our combination of modeling and psychophysical data. The key point here is that collinearity, which is roughly a form of recurrent excitation between orientation-sensitive neurons that are almost lined up, collinearity roughly doubles propagation speed. You can model all of this by taking the model the simplest model I presented to you, which was just a model responding to one eye's input. I'm sorry, neuron responding to one eye's input, neuron responding to the others with mutual inhibition, and making two circles of neurons, so extending this to a spatial dimension. If you do that and have a spread of inhibition, and in the case where there is collinear facilitation, a slightly longer range spread of excitation, this goes in both directions up here, you can reproduce the data quite nicely, quantitatively, and the difference in speeds. And just to show you what this simulation percept, the simulation, the way you make the measurements is you wait until, let's say, this pattern is the only one that's visible, and then if you have a little contrast pulse in the other pattern, it will always break through and reappear there, and over time, it will propagate around, and it keeps on propagating, and it turns out in this network, it propagates at a constant speed that, given reasonable assumptions of how far apart these neurons would have to be from what we know about human cortex, turns out to be both perceptual speed and what was subsequently measured directly in human cortex. Okay, I started a little late, so I've got little more time. Rivalry turns out to be interesting also because it engenders a form of perceptual short-term memory. And the phenomenon is the following. If you within about a half second after, let's say you're looking at horizontal, or I tend to do it as plus and minus 45 degrees because horizontal and vertical are skewed dimensions in that the horizon is very important for humans and vertical in some ways less important. So plus and minus 45 degrees, if you wait until, let's say, this pattern has just appeared, so you're not seeing what's in the other eye, and turn both stimuli off, just switch to a gray screen so that the person is seeing nothing, you can wait for up to about 5 seconds, 5 or 6 seconds with no stimuli. And when the stimuli reappear, with very high probability, you'll see the same stimulus you were seeing before. And you can do this again and again and again and again and again for several minutes, frequently. It's high probability. It's not certainty, to be sure. Yeah, repeat multiple times. And I'll show you a simulation of this, which may bring it home. We formed the hypothesis that, and this has not been tested, but it's an instance where here's a physiological hypothesis that can, in principle, be tested by physiologists, certainly not by me, that initial firing causes a rapid and temporary augmentation of the strength of excitatory synapses, perhaps due to something like very rapid vesicle docking, but that with prolonged firing for a few seconds, those vesicles are depleted, they're used, and the synapse would drop back to its original level. If you incorporate that into the same model I've shown you, so now we've embellished it to incorporate a nonlinearity in the synaptic strength, then you can turn on a stimulus, leave it for a while, and just after this eye has become dominant, this is about 700 milliseconds, we turn the stimulus off. This indicates when the stimulus is on, the red boxes. We turn the stimulus off for 5 seconds. Then we pulse the stimulus, and what happens is the same eye wins the competition. If we leave it on only for about 700 milliseconds, turn it off for another 5 seconds, and so on. And this is what the data indicate is happening. So we've generated essentially a form of temporary short-term perceptual memory for what the system last processed by adding in this nonlinearity in the synaptic strength. Because we've talked about switches in networks, and I suspect there are going to be more discussions of switches in networks. I just want to show you that, in fact, the transition, if you remember I said that rivalry is a default when the stimuli cannot be fused to extract depth information. Well, we've looked at that transition experimentally, and there is hysteresis in this. So what you can do is create a video movie. I won't show you a movie. I'll just show you, in essence, a few frames of it, of gratings that start identical in orientation, both vertical, in which case you just see a vertical fronto-parallel grating, and slowly counter-rotate, which is geometrically appropriate for the grating beginning to tilt in depth. At some point, of course, the tilt is too great, and it switches to rivalry, and you can measure those transitions. How about if I show it to you? What it means is that there is a range of a, in this case, stimulus parameter over which the system can be in either of, in this case, two states, but you can have multiple state hysteresis, either of two states contingent upon how it entered that regime. So contingent upon its recent history. Okay? The classic example is magnetic hysteresis, where you take, an iron nail and it isn't magnetized, but then you wrap it with wire, you run a current through, magnetize it. Now you take the wire off and it stays magnetized for a long time. So whether it's magnetized or not depends upon its previous history. So if you use the glasses again, this is just a quick run of that. This is frontoparallel. Now, these are at a very slight angle, and you should, although the conditions here aren't perfect, you should see this as a tilted grating, which will be tilted one way or the other, depending upon which eye you have the red over. Do people see that as tilted a bit? But then, if the angle becomes too great, it'll break down and begin to rival. Okay? I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. Yes, the sequence is, well, it'll be easier to show with the graph of, the graph of the results. I'll go over it now. Start out with, and this is a movie, so left eye is seeing a vertical grating, the right eye is seeing an identical grating. Then over time in the movie, they slowly rotate in opposite directions. This is geometrically equivalent to having a frontal plane tilt towards you or away from you. For small differences, the brain puts it together and sees depth. When it gets to too great a difference, there's a bifurcation. The brain switches to seeing rivalry. And what we were looking at is that transition. And we did this with an extension of the network that we talked about. The first network I talked about is now in the dashed line, so mutual inhibition between these. But if you also have neurons that respond to the same orientation in each eye, and these inhibit these inhibitory neurons, the circuit can switch. So you can get this sort of bifurcation. And this is just a way of showing what actually happens. If you start from angle of zero means they're both vertical. Move across, you get some activity in these neurons, and then they switch to rivalry right here. If you start at a very big angle, the system begins rivaling and continues to rival. I'm just showing one of the neurons here, until this point where it switches to uniform activity. And so there's this intermediate range of the stimulus parameter over which the system can be either not rivaling or rivaling, depending upon the history of stimulation. So that is the hysteresis phenomenon. So I'll close then with predictions and issues for the future. I'd say this is an example of a type of modeling that is going to continue to be relevant, along with many other types. I'm simply arguing for one type. Namely, using simplified spike rate equations, where we're not simulating each action potential, but just the mean firing rate. And we developed one of the earliest models of this, I believe, in the 1970s. The other things that we really need to work more on, there is feedback in this model, and I've extended it to two levels with feedback, but we know that there are complex multi-level feedback networks throughout the brain, something that Andre mentioned. And not only that, but there are different length feedback pathways. So if you have area A projecting to area B, which projects to area C, A typically also projects to area C. So there are both AB feedbacks and AC feedbacks, perhaps with different time constants. But we have very little theory, to my knowledge, on that sort of network. I've shown you models that have a single adaptation time constant. We know there are certainly quite a few, perhaps up to a dozen, different slow hyperpolarizing currents in neurons with different time constants. And it would be of relevance to know why that is and what dynamical or computational advantages accrue from that. And another thing which is starting to be done, and here I'll cite the work of Larry Abbott and Sobolinsky, I think I have that correct, They have looked at very large networks that have largely random connectivity and shown that as a function of the dispersion of the connectivity, you can get a network which begins to behave chaotically in the absence of an input, but still can amplify inputs and the inputs damp down the chaos. This is one way of looking at multiple feedback loops, because if you have, let's say, 1,000 neurons, each one of which is interconnected with 200 of the others with random strengths, you're going to have multiple length feedback loops arising with virtual certainty. And I think this may be one very interesting way in the future to look at these. So, thank you very much.
That's a much easier entry point for somebody who doesn't know that much about neuroscience than trying to jump in from a data-driven problem where, you know, start directly from data and build their own model. Now you can see that this past, you know, peer review is an existing model and it does these things, but hopefully you can see what it doesn't do, maybe by talking to the experimentalist, as you did in the later parts of your talk, when you refine the model, and then, you know, with your quantitative training, you can work on, you know, building off of the existing model.
Excellent point. Thank you. If you have roughly equal strength eyes, rivalry. If the angle between the two patterns, and it doesn't have to be two gratings, it can be a face in one eye and a house in another eye, and they will rival. It virtually always occurs. The rate will be idiosyncratic with your brain relative to someone else's. I can't answer that. Hopefully you only see someone you like. But well, one of the keys, and this has been one of the tricky things in doing brain imaging on rivalry, is that the system is both hierarchic and feedback. As Andre had a very nice slide of just the lowest levels of the system, there are several higher levels. If you have rivalry at a low level, contingent upon what's rivaling, you will see it manifested higher up the system as well. The case that was first done of that sort was by Frank Tong, who was then at Harvard and is now a professor at Vanderbilt, where he looked at rivalry between a face in one eye and a house in the other eye. And because these stimulated about the same number of cells in the earliest visual areas, rivalry was not obvious there. But there's an area called the fusiform face area and another area called the parahippocampal place area. So there's a specialized higher visual area for faces and a different one for scenes. And they saw a rivalry between those areas. So, but that was most likely a manifestation of things going on at a lower level that couldn't be teased apart. They've been received very well, because in general we have data with the models as well and test predictions of the models. I tried to just emphasize the modeling here, but I do, or my lab does, at least as much data collection as it does modeling. And furthermore, some other people in other labs have done spiking neuron models of rivalry, and you definitely still get rivalry. I have a demo of that sitting on the computer someplace, and again, if you're interested, I can show it during the breakout period. So one more, is that?
Yeah, maybe one more.
Yeah.
I wanted to point out another theme that came up in your talk that may be kind of a general thing in the field, and that is you mentioned that stimuli that would bring out binocular rivalry is not something that we were exposed to in our evolution very much. So in a sense, you're basically tickling the system with an unnatural stimulus to find out how it's wired up, and I think that's very similar to doing voltage clamp on neurons that would never, you know, receive a voltage clamp stimulus.